introduce our next speaker. And our next speaker is Dr. John Curvilla. And I'm not sure if I can do his CV because it was 14 and a half pages long, I think it was. So, John, forgive me if I... Well, you didn't give me a summary. So I needed a summary. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Yeah, two lines. He's a really great guy and he's a great doctor. There you go. John graduated, did his medical school at the University of Toronto. He did postgrad research and specialty training, and he was a clinical research fellow at the Division of Medical Oncology and Hematology at Princess Margaret. He has a specialist certification in hematology from the University of British Columbia. He has a fellowship in internal medicine, and he is currently an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Toronto, and he is a staff physician at the Division of Medical Oncology and Hematology at Princess Margaret Hospital. So would you please welcome Dr. John Curvilla. How'd I do, John? Not bad?
That's good, too. Who was that guy? So I grew up on Georgian Bay. I came to work in Toronto in large part because I wanted to come home and look after people around the area that I grew up in. So what we're going to do now is talk about a very specific area in lymphoma, namely Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a success story. As Sue has alluded to already, this is my main disclaimer. This is where I work. That's Princess Margaret Hospital. So, you know, we're the White Tower. We try to try to provide a lot of advice to people about lymphoma in general. We have lots of people who are very interested in doing this, a very, very good radiation oncology group. But at the same time, we still work in the same environment as everyone else, right? So we have the same access to drugs that you can get in Sarnia or in Owen Sound or what have you. We have some research available that's maybe a little different than that. But our goal, I think, much like all the other academic centers in Ontario, is we want to provide help and allow patients to get treated as close to home as well as possible. Okay? So Peter's set up a lot of this already, and so I'm just going to walk through quickly a couple of the things about what may make Hodgkin's lymphoma a bit different. And then really, I'm going to tell you a success story, because the treatment of Hodgkin's lymphoma is a success story, and it's a model that hopefully we'll see rolled out towards all other kinds of lymphoma, as well as many other kinds of cancer, because the treatment of this disease has become so effective. So Peter showed you more recent data than this, but the point of this slide is basically to say that Hodgkin's lymphoma is not the most common type of lymphoma that we see. The incidence is about 3 in 100,000. That makes out to a prevalence in Canada of about 350,000 people who have had or have the diagnosis, and the lifetime risk for a person is 1 in 250. Peter showed this slide already, but the important thing to see here is that on this side, where the abnormal malignant cell has been associated, there is no normal cell that we can relate to Hodgkin's lymphoma. So that biology point hasn't been made. One of the things that was described in the past 10 or 15 years, actually, is that we know now that Hodgkin's lymphoma really derives from a type of B lymphocyte. And that's important because that may be a scientific fact that will help us develop better treatment over time and understand potentially why this happens. Because, as Peter already mentioned, no one really understands why lymphomas develop in the majority of cases. This is a slide of what Hodgkin's lymphoma looks like, and as Peter had already mentioned, the owl's eye cell, the Reed-Sternberg cell, is the defined malignant cell, but unlike many types of cancers, you can see there's a lot going on there that isn't related to the malignant cell. And so you see that there are all these other things floating around, inflammatory cells and fibrosis, and this is one of the issues that Hodgkin's lymphoma can be a difficult thing to diagnose. That's because small needles may not give you the answer. And we're in an area of medicine, in 2012, where people are as minimalist as possible. Why put people through big surgical procedures where you may need to be admitted to hospital when we can do things potentially, in an outpatient unit where radiologists under guidance will use small needles? And so that's great if it gets you the right answer. But in this scenario, invariably it doesn't. And that's why, again, from a policy standpoint, we generally demand an excisional biopsy, so something with big enough tissue that we can make the call. Now, there are always circumstances where that may not be possible, depending on how sick someone is or where the disease is. But really, at the end of the day, we want our pathologist to have as much tissue to work with to make the call, and so that you don't get into an issue where if you're just sampling an area up here and this is what you see, you have no idea what you're dealing with. So Hodgkin's lymphoma also really isn't one disease, and these are the subtypes that are broken down by frequency. It's not so much important for the classical types because the therapy is generally very similar, but it may be important with diseases like this subtype called lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin's lymphoma, where there may be examples that the behavior of the disease may be a bit different. Okay, but the point is, the pathologists tell us this information, it may factor in with what we do, but in large part, unlike non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, where there are many different subtypes that have significantly different treatments and approaches, classical Hodgkin's is generally treated fairly straightforwardly in one manner. So I've already highlighted this point. We're happy to use fine needles in the circumstance where someone has already had a known diagnosis made and there's a question of confirmation or looking at an additional site or potentially recurrence. But this is an area where more is always better. And this is an area where if the pathologists are less familiar with this type of disease, that consultation is often already built into the system. So again, if you're at a small community hospital in Northern Ontario, this stuff usually gets sent into a handful of expert centers, either around GTA or Ottawa or London or what have you. So it's often reviewed by an academic hematopathologist that has access to all of those tools that Peter was already talking about. So the staging, as Peter said, exactly the same. I'm not going to dwell on any of this in any real detail. But to highlight here that this definition of staging, called Ann Arbor because it was developed at Ann Arbor, Michigan, was designed for Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it's now been generalized to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it was also designed in a time where radiation was the primary treatment. Because if you think of how this is really designed, it's designed to help radiation doctors determine if they could give radiation successfully in a localized manner. Okay, and now, where the paradigm has shifted and chemotherapy is the primary treatment, this is still important. It may help us assess risk and prognosis and outcome, and it will also help us deliver radiation, but I'll argue it's maybe a little less important in terms of outcome, as I'll hopefully show you here in the next few slides. So this is a slide from the group in British Columbia about that prognostic score Peter talked about. And I showed this slide yesterday at this meeting to make a point, which was that more than 10 years or almost 20 years ago when this score was initially designed, all of these outcomes were down here. Okay, and you could pick a group of people that had four or five of these risk factors, and their cure rate was less than 50%. And that's using similar treatment. But in the past 10 or 15 years, treatment with Hodgkin's lymphoma, we've just gotten better at giving standard treatment, better at giving ABVD, which is the primary treatment. And now the cure rates, even with people that have the most Hodgkin's lymphoma on board, at a minimum, everyone has roughly at least a 60 or 65% cure rate. And so in this disease, you know, that's a big deal because we've managed to evolve a lot in terms of outcome. So I like to have a discussion about this one. This one usually comes up in the setting of treatment often after we've completed chemotherapy. So as Peter had alluded to, we may modify therapy based on the type of disease or age and fitness of a person, but we're not really in the true age of personalized or individualized medicine yet because we don't get a gene expression printout of a tumor and give you drugs from lung cancer if we know those drugs are those targets are at play. So that's maybe the true definition of personalized medicine. But what we're very good at doing in the clinic is balancing potential toxicities of these drugs against effectiveness and really trying to tailor treatment to the person based on how they are, how well they are, and what those problems are. The point we dwell a lot on, is the idea of remission versus cure. Oncologists traditionally have a very tough time using the word cure sometimes because we know it's time dependent. We can tell someone they're in remission because we can do a CT scan and say there's no evidence of disease. That's what remission is, no evidence of active disease. And that's a specific snapshot of a period in time. Cure is just remission maintained forever. And the stupid thing I say is if I know you're in remission and you try to run across University Avenue to head over to Starbucks and get a coffee and you get hit by a bus and die, you were cured. Okay, so you see my point, right? Because you ended up, we knew you were alive and you died and you didn't have cancer. Okay, so what we do as a surrogate for that, though, is when we know the risk of the disease coming back is very low, that's when we think we likely say you're cured, and that's where that magical five-year mark comes from, okay? Because most of those curves, as you saw, within the first couple of years drop off, and then they level, and usually after 3, 4, or 5 years, the chance of going out of remission is very low. That's going to be a little more challenging in this day and age, because as Peter had shown you, indolent lymphomas that we often don't cure by definition, they're incurable. We can now put people into remission for 5 years with treatment, or people may not need treatment over 5 years. So it's a bit of a moving target, but it's important to understand the rationale why remission doesn't always imply cure. So in Hodgkin's lymphoma, though, we have a very clear treatment philosophy. It is cure because this is a very curable disease. And when there is less disease on board, the likelihood of cure is higher. And what I'm going to show you now is that we're at the point in the treatment of Hodgkin's lymphoma that we can actually pull back on the treatment. We can reduce the amount of chemotherapy we give. We can reduce the amount of radiation or the role of radiation. And we can potentially cure people. The difficulty here is that where the cure rate is lower, we're still not smart enough necessarily to have a better solution yet. But the philosophy in cancer care is often to intensify the treatment. And that may work in a subset of people, and I'll show you an example of that, but that's not always the case. So the is more better question comes up time and time again, even in lymphoma. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that just, taking out a big treatment that comes with a lot of toxicity doesn't imply better control of your cancer. So Peter didn't touch a lot about chemotherapy, but standard chemotherapy drugs work by damaging DNA. And so these are growing cells that are affected. The usual inference here is that cancer cells are the cells growing most rapidly in your body, so those are the ones that preferentially chemotherapy will hit. But these are not elegant targeted drugs, and so we also affect the normal cells that are growing in your body all the time. Blood cells, the lining of the mouth and the bowel, and that's why the side effects then become predictable. Low blood counts, diarrhea, inflammation in the mouth, nausea, mucositis, those sorts of things, even hair loss because you're constantly growing hair. And the advantage of chemotherapy, I guess, in this scenario would be in a blood-based disease, it's a systemic treatment. It travels through the bloodstream, and that's firstly why, as opposed to radiation, this has really changed the way we give therapy in Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it's become the preferred first part of treatment. So here's the standard treatment. It's this four-drug regimen called ABVD. A cycle is 1 month, and a cycle involves two treatments because the standard cycle is given every 2 weeks. Those are the four drugs. They're the dose. They're the doses. I mean, that's less important. But they all sort of have these specific side effects associated with them. So the first one, when you give too much of it, and that would be potentially when you get up to potentially giving 9 treatments or more, which is why we never do that, there's risk of injury to the heart, and so you'll often see we test heart function before we get into therapy. Bleomycin can cause lung inflammation, and again, that's where we will often get baseline breathing tests and make sure that people are able to start on this safely. The other drugs involve things like peripheral neuropathy, so nerve injury, potentially effects on skin, etc. And so we try to assess all of these things early because if there's a way that we need to consider to modify a standard regimen, we want to do that. But it's important here because when we don't defer from this very much, it's a very, very effective treatment. So that's why this is the default in almost everyone with Hodgkin's lymphoma. Radiation, I think in general, I'll say it will apply only to the setting where you have localized disease, so typically one or two places or maybe one big place in particular. The treatment typically is a Monday to Friday thing that's given for about 4 weeks. And the side effects compared to chemo, which are often systemic, radiation is a local side effect typically, so the skin and tissue beneath where the radiation is given. So I think Dr. Sang will probably cover this a bit more in detail later in the day, and it's better to hear about radiation from a radiation doctor than from me. But one of the principles here, remember, even if it's the same treatment and a patient with lymphoma is getting radiation to the same spot as someone with a solid tumor in the head and neck, the radiation dose is lower, so the side effects are less likely to be as significant. And because the diseases we treat are often easier to treat, the outcome may be better. Okay, but radiation here, just like chemotherapy, it's not all one, and the side effects that you compare with someone who's going through a treatment for a different disease are often not likely to be similar. Hopefully this projects well back there, but these are the standard radiation fields that have been used in lymphoma for a long time. What I'd say in general, hopefully Richard has more recent pictures he can show you, because the fields have often gotten smaller. As we've learned over time, with more modern techniques and better machines and imaging, you can give smaller fields and still preserve the same good cure rates that we see. So a lot of patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma will get what we call combined modality therapy. And so that's combining chemotherapy followed by radiation. And this is our current standard treatment in people with localized Hodgkin's lymphoma. We don't tend to use radiation in more widespread disease. That may be the norm in Europe, but that's not something that's been adopted in North America because there isn't a lot of convincing data that it shows that it makes patients live longer. But we may consider radiation in people with more widespread disease if there was one big spot in particular at the beginning, or if it was a spot that didn't respond well, or maybe, as Peter suggested, if a PET scan shows that there's something left over that lights up. But that's an area that there still isn't a ton of data, and the decision-making can sometimes be a bit complicated. So in general, the cure rates with this disease are, as I've shown you, at a minimum 65% and potentially as high as 80 or 90%. And the lesson from Hodgkin's lymphoma is the way that therapy got better is people had discipline to do studies comparing one treatment versus another, waiting 5, 10, 12 years to get a result to move forward and change the field. And that's something we have to be very careful in what we balance, because what you may read is state-of-the-art from a cutting-edge center may only have 2 or 3 years of follow-up behind it. And, places like us, we're not keen to adopt those strategies unless we have a problem with what we're doing currently, until we know for certain with 5, 6, 8, 10 years of follow-up that we don't see consequences later, like lower cure rates or different toxicities. And so in this disease, just like in many others, there's a balance again between needing good data so that we don't expose risk to people, but at the same time, still studying these things to learn more about what to do. And so this is a good example of pulling away treatment. And you won't be able to see that those two curves there differ at all at the back, and it's because they look exactly the same. And what this trial showed was that you could give half the chemotherapy, so 2 months versus 4 months of ABVD, in people with very little Hodgkin's lymphoma, give a lower dose of radiation, and the cure rate was just as good at above 90%. And so this is one of the studies that's influenced our current policy at PMH. In people with a little bit more disease or with one or two risk factors, so blood tests, et cetera, that may be a little abnormal, what this study showed was, again, in terms of toxicity of treatment, they had looked at a more aggressive chemotherapy than ABVD in this trial. And it didn't make that big a difference with a balance of ABVD and a slightly higher dose of radiation. And so again, this as well has influenced our current treatment policy at PMH. This study is a Canadian trial. I'm just going to show you this to make a quick point. Radiation generally in localized disease improves remission. Okay, and we think that the implication there is that should make people live longer. The issue then becomes, when you follow people long enough, and I will talk about this later in the day, is what are some of the risks that we set ourselves up for at 5 or 10 or 12 years after you're completing treatment? And one of those things may be things like second cancers in places that have received radiation, potentially side effects to the heart, depending on where the radiation was directed, or chemotherapy drugs that can affect that. And the trade-offs here may be we do a better job at curing your disease to set you up potentially for complications down the road. And so the decision-making here gets very complicated when you have to factor all of those things into play. This study, though, was done at a time where the radiation fields were much like what we did in the 90s and not the more targeted, smaller fields with lower doses today. And again, a lot of work in our building going on with how to do this safely, still give radiation and protect people from later complications. So these regimens that we use do have a mixture of side effects. And again, people who've been through chemotherapy are very familiar with what we need to watch for during the treatment: nausea, low blood counts, potentially risks of infection. But when we give more drugs, multiple combinations, those risks are higher. And the trade-offs with Hodgkin's, we've learned, is that while 7 or 8 drugs potentially may improve disease control, that's a trade-off with down the road seeing more consequences: higher rates of infertility in young people, higher rates of second cancers potentially. And the studies here have shown that in general, giving more drugs, more standard drugs anyway, hasn't really made that much of a difference. And that's because standard treatment, if you can give it well, goes very smoothly. And so the treatment algorithm here, we really break it down on if the disease is localized or not. And in localized disease, we tend to give shorter courses of chemotherapy followed by radiation. And the radiation question here is key, and that's where we usually recommend consultation early with our colleagues in radiation oncology to see what's feasible and safe. And then in the advanced stage disease, so that was, as Peter referred to, stage 3 or 4, people with B symptoms, people with big masses greater than 10 centimeters, we tend to give higher doses or more courses of chemotherapy because there is a higher risk of lymphoma recurrence. But as I showed you, even in the worst case scenario, the cure rate now is probably above 65%. We often get asked to see people at our center if primary treatment doesn't work. And so firstly, I'll remember, even though this may be a lot of what we do, it thankfully is not a common problem. And so again, from first principles, it would sort of make sense that a disease that comes back very soon after chemotherapy or grows during chemotherapy is perhaps a little harder to deal with than someone who has their disease come back at 1, 2, 3, or 4 years. And we believe that that represents drug resistance. So the idea that these cancer cells have gone through Darwinian selection. So essentially that we've gotten rid of the good players, the ones that are left over are ugly, nasty cells that are resistant to the drugs in ABVD. And so what do? We give them different drugs, and then if those drugs work, we go on to do an autologous stem cell transplant. So this is a type of bone marrow transplant where we collect stem cells from the patient themselves, so this is from a donor, and the purpose of the transplant is to give very, very high doses of chemotherapy, because that's one of the mechanisms we can take advantage of to overcome drug resistance in cancer cells. And this is the study that actually, or one of the studies, one of the two studies that has shown that autologous transplant improves being alive and in remission in the setting if your Hodgkin's lymphoma comes back. So depending on where you live or where someone may go, the specifics of the transplant strategy may vary. And again, the chemotherapy you may get as a second choice, again, varies across the world. There's a Canadian regimen that Mike helped, that Mike really led to develop, GDP, that we use a lot in Canada. People collect stem cells differently. The chemotherapy part of the transplant may vary, but the principles are generally the same, and the cure rates with a transplant in the second line setting are between 40 to 50% in general. And so if you look at that, I guess you could say the cup is half full or half empty, but it is uncommon in cancers that you get a second chance to actually cure a disease. And in aggressive lymphoma and Hodgkin's lymphoma, we are able to do that. And it's one of the important things that we're happy to see people as needed quickly to help facilitate this kind of treatment. And this is, again, the regimen that we use, but it varies center to center, potentially in Canada, and certainly varies across North America and into Europe. And so to run through what we do very quickly, so we look at this scenario with localized disease, and we tend to potentially vary the dose of or the amount of chemotherapy between 2 and 4 months, and we may vary the amount of radiation between 20 and 30 gray, depending on how much disease is on board, and potentially some other risk factors that help stratify people with localized disease into a better risk and a poorer risk group. But they, both groups generally do quite well. And in the advanced setting, again, the reliance is on ABVD, where we're typically giving between 6 to 8 months of therapy, and we may consider radiation in a site that has some bulk and particularly may use things like PET scans to help sort things out. Second line, our goal is to transplant everybody if they're medically well enough and fit enough to go through a procedure. And again, as I said, the details of this are less important, but it usually involves being connected with a center that does transplantation fairly early on when we know that this is potentially going to be a treatment to use. And so with that, as Peter mentioned in the beginning, confirming the diagnosis is the key, because at the end of the day, you want to be sure that you're treating the right problem, because this is a problem that can be treated very effectively. Staging becomes important because, as I've showed you, we vary the amount of treatment that we give. We vary the role of radiation or not. But the chemotherapy part of this is very straightforward. It's ABVD. So the advantage here, this is a treatment that's been around since the 70s. You learn about it in med school. You learn about it in residency. You learn about it in fellowship. So everybody should feel comfortable with giving this regimen. Once they know that the diagnosis is right, and again, we're happy to be available to provide guidance about number of treatments or what have you, and we're also there for that for the rarer group of people who have this treatment not really work very well, because the second line treatment is potentially successful as well with a transplant. And so with that, I'll conclude, and thank you.